President Obama announced plans this morning to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, the detention facility that houses alleged enemy combatants and terrorists.
For many years, it's been clear that the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay does not advance our national security. It undermines it. This is not just my opinion. This is the opinion of experts. This is the opinion of many in our military. It's counterproductive to our fight against terrorists because they use it as propaganda in their efforts to recruit.
The president's plan faces an uphill battle in Congress, where the prevailing belief is that closing the facility would free people who could potentially pose security threats to the United States.
Joining us now to discuss the president's plan and how it'll fare in Washington is Jeremy Suri. He's the Mack Brown Distinguished Professor for Global Leadership, History, and Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on. My pleasure.
Well, President Obama came into office. He ran on the idea of closing Guantanamo. He's tried on and off over the last 7 years and a couple months to do it. It hasn't happened. Is there anything different now, anything different about this plan that makes it look like it's going to close before he leaves office?
Well, there are two things that are slightly different. There are fewer detainees now in Guantanamo than there were before. There were as many as 500 or even more than that at one point. There are now about 91, so it's a slightly smaller number. And second, he is in his last year as president, and on the one hand, that reduces his leverage. On the other hand, it means he doesn't have to be concerned about seeking his own reelection anymore. And if this is something he really cares about, even if there are high political costs, he might be willing to pay them right now.
Right. There are different groups of detainees still at Guantanamo. Some, in theory, could be sent back to different countries. Some can't, though, and the thought is they would come to facilities on the mainland United States. Congress has said no, specifically in their Defense Department authorization. They said, no, you can't do that. Can he do that with an executive action, as some people have said, as commander-in-chief?
Well, there's a debate about that. Clearly, it's not what he would prefer to do, nor would it be the preferred move for anyone, I think, because it would be better not to have a conflict between the executive and Congress over whose authority should be in power here. But we're already in that space. This conflict precedes this particular issue. The president is commander-in-chief, and traditionally, the commander-in-chief has the legal authority to oversee enemy noncombatants. That's the situation we're in right here, and that is actually the basis upon which the Bush administration initially brought these detainees to Guantanamo. They were initially brought there under the authority the president had to deal with enemy combatants and noncombatants. And so the question here now is whether that authority allows the president, in defiance of Congress, to under his authority as commander-in-chief, to move these detainees into the United States. And I don't think there's a clear determination there. I think the Supreme Court would have to make that decision, and we know that that's problematic right now, too.
Before we get more into those details, let's talk about Guantanamo as a symbol. The president, we just heard, saying this is the continued existence of Guantanamo, the presence of detainees there, is propaganda value for international terrorists. We hurt ourselves more by having it than we would by getting rid of it. Do you think he's on the right track?
Well, I think he is in two levels that he discussed today, Rob. First, there's no doubt that Guantanamo is excellent propaganda value for our opponents, whether they include terrorist organizations or individuals like Vladimir Putin. It shows that in many ways we're not living up to the values we claim to live up to and the values we expect other countries to live up to in the treatment of individuals, in the use of due process under the law, in basic fairness. We've held for 15 years many of these people without officially charging them or giving them a trial. So that's one way. There's a propaganda problem. But second, I do think it also hurts us because we are trying to not only attract friends around the world, we are trying to, in this region of the world, and trying to build goodwill for what we're doing. And it's not just the propaganda value that's a problem for us. It's actually the challenge to the way our law, our rule of law, operates. And I think President Obama believes that at home and abroad, we are not standing up for the values that we wish to stand up for, and we should live those values for our own purposes, not just for propaganda purposes.
On the other hand, people are saying, hey, there's risk here. If you send detainees back to their home country, they might again take up arms, or for the first time in some cases take up arms against the United States. If they're in prisons on United States soil, that's a risk. That's maybe a terrorist target, some kind of propaganda value to attacking, trying to free them. So is there a risk involved in closing Guantanamo, relocating those remaining detainees?
I don't think so, no. I don't think that's actually a fair argument. I think that we have great experience in our country in holding and adjudicating individuals who are high-value targets, who are dangerous, who could both be a problem if they escaped and who would attract the attention of people who might want to use the facilities where they're being held as targets. You don't have to be an international terrorist. You could be a leader of a mafia organization, an organized crime unit of one kind or another. We've dealt with this before. We've had trials for dangerous people. We've held them, and we haven't had major problems. I don't think this is something that's outside of the range of our capabilities, nor is it outside of the range of our experience.
We're talking about President Obama's call today to close the Guantanamo Bay prison. We're talking to Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas at Austin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Guantanamo be closed? Should some of the detainees there be moved to prisons here in the United States? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue this conversation in just a few moments.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our discussion now about President Obama's plan to close the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. Joining us is Jeremy Suri. He is Mac Brown Distinguished Professor for Global Leadership, History, and Public Policy at the University of Texas, Austin. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Is it time to close Guantanamo, relocate the detainees there, or do we need it? Do we need to expand it, as some Republican presidential candidates are saying? 800-642-1234. Jeremy, it seems like this is going to be a hard sell for the president to Congress. Senator John McCain, former presidential candidate, has said, yeah, he supports closing Guantanamo, but he says this plan from the president is flimsy. He doesn't think it answers the questions that Congress has raised in the past. If he's not on board, is anybody going to be?
Well, I don't think President Obama is going to get a lot of initial support from Republicans for the same reason he's not going to get initial support for a nominee to the Supreme Court. They want to oppose everything he does. But I also don't think that most Americans are happy with things in Guantanamo and want that to go on forever. I think the average American would like to see Guantanamo closed as well. And I think if we can show that of these the small number, the 91 remaining detainees, that we can get a large number of countries to take most of them, and then we can bring the small number to the United States and show Americans that they can be held safely, I think a case can be made. I'm not sure one can get support from Congress, but the president is trying to argue that it will save money, too, and that might actually pull a few votes. All he needs is a few Republicans to be willing to go along with this, or he can issue an executive order and say that he's actually following the will of the American people, even if the Republicans in Congress won't allow that. If he can show that there's a strong public opinion, strong support from the public to move the detainees, the few remaining detainees to the United States, he might then have some justification for issuing an executive order.
Is the core problem here that there's still a gray area, still maybe unresolved, that we have people that we've captured, they're not wearing a uniform of an enemy state, they're not in an army as traditionally defined, yet they mean harm to the United States, and we don't know exactly whether that's a criminal, illegal, an act of war situation? It's just, as I said, a gray area.
Well, I do think that's all true, Rob. It is a gray area, but I don't actually think that's what this issue is about anymore. This is actually a classic issue of the vestiges and the elements and legacies of a war that we're dealing with 15 years after the fact. We put these detainees in Guantanamo because it was expedient at the time, and now we don't want them to be in Guantanamo, but we don't want them in our country either, because some of them, we're convinced, are really bad guys, and I'm sure some of them really are. And we don't want them in the United States, and we don't want them in Guantanamo. We don't know what to do with them. So they're a legacy problem. And there is the question over whether they're combatants or not combatants, which law should apply to them. But I think that's actually a secondary issue, because President Obama is simply proposing right now to bring them to the United States, not even to subject them to traditional American legal procedure. So we're dealing with a legacy. We have these people held somewhere. We don't know where to put them, and we don't want to bring them here. And that's the problem.
We're going to call her now. We've got Fred on the line in Sheboygan. Fred, hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
But go ahead, Fred.
Oh, yes. I strongly, as a veteran, I'm a disabled veteran from the Vietnam era, and I strongly disagree with closing Guantanamo Bay. That's a military base for military prisoners, and really, military prisoners are just that. They're not, you know, they're not to be governed by attorneys. They don't belong in jails, and they certainly don't have the rights of a citizen and the right to be represented by a lawyer. This stuff is all new. Seems like things have evolved over the last few years to paint a rosy picture on everything, but most of these guys would kill you with a smile on their face, and I don't understand where the public's coming from, or especially the president of our United States, who sees all of our men come home and after serving to protect our country, and turn those people are animals.
Fred, thanks for the call. So public opinion, some goes the other way, Jeremy. There are people who still say, no, don't remove the detainees from Guantanamo. It's the appropriate place for, Fred says, military prisoners.
Well, I first of all, I respect Fred's service and understand where he's coming from, but I respectfully disagree on two counts. We have a long tradition of running military prisons. All modern militaries do that. Military prisons are designed to be temporary locations. They're not designed to be long-term incarceration facilities, and they're certainly not supposed to be adjudicating difficult judgments over guilt and innocence. They are simply designed to hold people who are an imminent threat. We have been holding these individuals who are in Guantanamo for 15 years. There's no way to define that as anything but long-term incarceration, and that's not what military prisons have ever done in our society or in most other modern societies. The equivalent would be the gulag in the Soviet Union, and we shouldn't be running gulags. Second point where I disagree with Fred respectfully is that we don't know if all 91 of those who are remaining are the cold-blooded killers he claims they are. I don't know how he knows that, because we don't really know much about these people. There might be some. I'm sure there are some like that, but there might be some who we're holding who are not that bad. We've made a mistake. Or maybe they're no longer a threat. Maybe they were. That's why we have a criminal justice system. That's why we have a system for adjudication. It's not for us to make that judgment and to call them animals without knowing who they are. That's unfair, and that actually does a disservice. That was my second point before, to our own system of justice. It's not just about propaganda. It's about what kind of justice system do we want in a society that's supposed to be a democracy.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Jeremy Suri. He's Mack Brown Distinguished Professor for Global Leadership, History, and Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. We've been talking about President Obama's plans to close the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. The upcoming rematch for a U.S. Senate seat between Senator Ron Johnson and Democratic challenger Russ Feingold is already getting national attention and money.
In the last 3 months of 2015, Feingold raised over $2.5 million. Johnson raised over $1.5 million. Add in a vacant Supreme Court seat left by the recent passing of Justice Antonin Scalia and a national contest for control of the Senate. A lot of people watching this race really closely.
Lily Gorin joins us now. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University. Lily, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on today.
Well, let's take a look at some pretty recent polling. This is from January from the latest Marquette Law School poll. It had Russ Feingold supported by 50% of registered voters and Republican incumbent Ron Johnson receiving 37%. In November, not much different. Feingold was at 49%, Johnson 38%. Any surprises there in those numbers to you?
Well, that they're holding pretty solid. There hasn't been all that much campaigning yet by either Feingold or Johnson, so that voters are not necessarily being asked to pay all that much attention to either campaign or candidate. But it is an open seat, and we, of course, are seeing more and more of the attention being paid at the presidential level. So, you know, Wisconsinites are starting to sort of pay attention to what's going on and who's running for office, but there wasn't much of a change, in part, I don't think, because there has been all that much campaigning going on.
How important would you say that this particular race is in the big picture of the Senate?
This is a pretty important race in terms of it's one of the seats that the Democrats think they can switch. And it's one of the seats that the Republicans need to hold on to in order to maintain a majority control in the Senate.
So I want to talk a little bit about the money, and apparently these are both raising a lot of money here in terms of the campaigns. Both candidates have super PAC money rolling in. Can you talk a little bit about how the donations are coming in, where they're coming from?
Well, there's both raising money inside the state and raising money also outside of the state. And this is likely to be a pretty expensive Senate race, like the last time that Johnson and Feingold ran against each other. The difference this time is that, as Feingold has said, the playing field has shifted a bit with regard to campaign finance, and so he is taking outside funds. In the previous race, he didn't really take outside funds.
And so the campaign of Senator Ron Johnson is saying, look, you know, Russ Feingold is turning his back on what he said earlier, that he would not raise money from out of Wisconsin. Any sense of how that is going over with possible voters?
Again, it is what Ron Johnson has said, and he's, you know, and there's been news clips of him saying that, but the campaigns are not sort of really at full throttle, if you want, at this point. And so I don't know how many people who aren't necessarily sort of political junkies like you and I are paying all that close attention to some of these discussions. I think it will probably become a bigger issue as the campaign starts running ads and as you see both Feingold and Johnson spending more time on the campaign trail in Wisconsin, that this is probably going to be a point of attack by Johnson and one that Feingold is going to have to defend himself against throughout the campaign.
We're talking about the 2016 U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin between incumbent Ron Johnson and former Senator Russ Feingold, talking now with Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. And so you mentioned that as being a possible item of contention when the campaign really swings into gear. What else do you see as being the marquee issues?
Well, I mean, I do think that this issue around the appointment of a replacement for Justice Scalia is going to be an issue. The discussion also broadly about whether or not there's a Democratic or Republican majority in the Senate is going to be an issue. I think that former Senator Feingold will probably run attacking Johnson with regard to perhaps his less than sort of constant visibility and engagement in the state. A lot of people in the poll, in the Marquette poll, also didn't know who Ron Johnson was. That's not a great situation for a sitting senator in your state.
So why would you say that some of the people in that poll did not know who Ron Johnson was? Is that typical that there will be a part of the electorate, or at least those polled, who just are not familiar with the candidates?
Yeah, I mean, it is normal that there are people who don't know who their senators are and their representatives are, and there are various ways to ask that question without necessarily, you know, can you name the person by name, or you can sort of explain who that person is. But one of the critiques from, I think, both the right and the left with regard to Johnson is that he doesn't necessarily have a lot of substantial visibility in the state of Wisconsin, that there are things that he's done with regard to the state, and there are things that he talks about with regard to the state, but that he's not necessarily somebody that you see all the time in the Journal Sentinel or the Wisconsin State Journal or, you know, on television, and so that he has less than a sort of vibrant, if you like, reputation in the state of Wisconsin.
Now, you mentioned the issue of filling that seat vacated by the recent death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Is it possible that the entire political race, looking at the presidential race and everything on down, will become more about that seat and who gets to fill it, and then everything will be sort of seen through that filter? Could that be the big issue?
Well, I don't know if that would be the big issue, but I think it will be probably more of a high-profile issue than sort of Supreme Court vacancies are usually in presidential races. The base voters in both the Republican and the Democratic side are always talking about Supreme Court vacancies and lower court vacancies as one of the, you know, prime ways that a president, you know, has a lasting legacy, because he appoints people who are then on the bench for quite a few years after that. But most of the time, the majority of voters don't necessarily think of that, because it's a multi-step sort of process of understanding. The president appoints, the Senate approves, the person's on the court, it's another branch of government. It's not the same thing as sort of saying, you know, I want to create these many jobs, or, you know, let's turn the unemployment numbers around. That kind of is a much more sort of understandable policy area. But because of the current battle that we're in already with regard to the filling of Scalia's seat, that it becomes a more high-profile issue that candidates will be campaigning on. And, you know, Ted Cruz has been campaigning on Supreme Court appointments since he decided to run for president. So it's not like it's not something that candidates talk about, but I think it will be more high-profile than in previous races.
Right, and obviously, as you said, it's a presidential election year. So what does that mean for this particular race? And as a subset to that, if Donald Trump is the candidate on the Republican side, what does that do to turnout in this race?
Well, I mean, again, Donald Trump, if Donald Trump is the nominee, I don't really know exactly what it will do with regard to turnout on the Democratic side, on the Republican side. It's sort of unclear at this point, because, you know, how he continues to perform in the primaries is still open. Is, you know, are his numbers going to get bigger? He's still coming in under 50% in the places where he's winning, because you still have multiple other people in the field who are getting 10, 12, 15%. And so it's not a two-person race in the Republican Party. But it remains to be seen if he will be somebody who generates more people coming to the polls, or if there are people who choose not to vote because he's on the ticket, and that affects the down-ballot candidates as well.
Now, Senator Johnson recently expressed some concern over Syrian refugees maybe entering the United States through Canada, because the Canadian Prime Minister said he would want to expedite the refugee approval process. What do you know about his views on that and how that could affect the issue of national security?
Well, I've read a little bit about this, but the policy that the United States has, that, you know, Senator Johnson and many members of the House and the Senate, has been to sort of actually tighten the sort of refugee pipeline into the United States. And so while Canada may be bringing more refugees in, you know, movement from Canada to the United States as refugees is not necessarily just a sort of open flow. And so I'm not necessarily exactly sure, you know, how much the connection is between what Canada does and what the United States also chooses to do, because we have been sort of redefining some of the policy about refugees coming into the United States.
Looking just a little bit at Russ Feingold, he was the senator for quite a while. People, I guess, has some name recognition there still going for him. But do you have a sense of how people's perception of him in Wisconsin may have changed while he was out of that seat?
Well, I mean, he's been out of the seat for 6 years, and, you know, he's been out of the state, and he's been back in the state, and he hasn't had that high of visibility or that much of a presence in the state since he left office as a senator. But I think it might be a little bit of a different situation than the most recent returnee to public life, Tommy Thompson, who had been actually out of, you know, the state of Wisconsin for a longer period of time and out of electoral politics for a longer period of time. But at the same time, that Russ Feingold has to reintroduce himself to, you know, Wisconsin voters. There are a lot of people who don't know him, who never voted for him before, who may be new to the state, or they're new voters, like a lot of my students. You know, 6 years ago, they weren't even in high school. And so they, you know, they may know his name, may be associated with McCain-Feingold legislation, but they don't necessarily know who he is as a candidate. And so he does actually have to spend time on the stump and throughout the state, you know, introducing himself and reintroducing himself, as it were.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good luck with the pledge drive.
Thanks. That was Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. We've been talking about the 2016 U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin.